Campus FM presents Talking Eds, a program brought to you by students from the International Masters in Adult Education for Social Change, who are studying currently at the University of Malta.
Hello and a very warm welcome. I'm Kainat Khurshid, your host for the day. In today's program, we will be discussing the role of adult education with regards to community development. In the studio from the Talking Eds team, we have Hannah Bland. Hannah has studied sustainable and international development with anthropology and has experience working on participatory community-led initiatives in Spain, Mexico, and Myanmar. Welcome.
Yeah.
Our studio guest for today is Seroz Casey, about whom I would like to say just a few words by way of an introduction before we move on. Seroz has worked with civil society organizations for more than 6 years in Nepal, in both policy and implementation level. He has worked closely to design and implement the projects related to community development, human rights, and social justice. Throughout his work, he has intensively emphasized on community empowerment initiatives to bring about a social change. One such initiative is Reflect Circles, implemented in 22 rural communities of Nepal and has set a model for community development in the country. Welcome to Talking Eds, Seroz.
Thank you.
Since we just talked about your work with Reflect Circles, can you please elaborate a bit that what exactly they are and how did you design them?
Reflect, it's a tool for informal adult education, which is basically inspired from the work of Paulo Freire, what he did in Brazil to promote literacy. So what we did was gathered, organized the community into one forum and provided them this forum like a circle. And basically the idea was to provide them literacy education, but simultaneously it was an initiative for community development.
Nice. Can you please elaborate a bit about what community development is and how it is perceived, in your opinion?
Well, when we talk about community development, we mostly emphasize on more on structural level. Say, for instance, when you say community development, we talk about infrastructure, economic prosperity, and mostly materialistic thing. But in my experience, I would say a lot of theories emphasize as well. So community development, it's basically about people. It's basically about when people understand and are aware of what's happening around them and realize what they have, what problems they are facing through, and organize collectively so that they are able to mitigate their own problems and change their lives by themselves. So I would say that's community development, actually.
Hannah, in your experience, how would you try to explain that what community development is?
Yeah, I would agree with Seroz. I think it's become a bit of a buzzword, and there's a lot of sort of buzzwords in the field like participation and empowerment and things like that. But I would say it would be about resilience and consciousness of the people in the community. So I guess community development for me is facilitating an environment in which the people in a community themselves come to an understanding of their situation and feel able to do something about it. So that's how I would understand it now.
Okay, and since we are in the field of adult education, how would you link these two themes up? Or are they kind of interlinked or not at all?
Well, as I said before, adult education and community development are, like two sides of a coin. Mm-hmm. I would say there cannot be community development if there's no adult education in that, because, as I said, community development, it's about people. It's about consciousness of people to understand their lives and to initiate and to act to change their lives. So even the purpose of adult education is it's about people. It's about social change. So that's what community development is for as well. So I would say even when adult education talks about conscientization and praxis, so I would also relate that with community development, which emphasizes people's understanding and their action.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's confusing because people also don't have a homogeneous understanding of what education is either. And I think on our course, it seemed like education and community development have been basically the same. Everything that I've learned on this course has been very similar to what I learned in community development, because the education that we're talking about is for social change and is about empowerment and consciousness, like you said. But I guess if listeners or other people are approaching education as sort of the transfer of some knowledge or information, then it's quite different in that regard. So it depends how we're looking at education, I guess.
In the field of community development, how do you guys would suggest some of the challenges that you might have faced or the opportunities it presents when it comes to adult education through community development work?
For me, I see, you know, earlier I said that there may not be community development where if there's no adult education, because, you know, in several communities, mostly they don't come just like that. Mm. And, you know, they need to be organized. They need to be sensitized. So there should, in many cases, it's from experience, you know, there's always been a facilitator within the group who has, you know, initiated the dialogues among the community, posed questions about what's happening around the community so that they could reflect what they are going through. So I would say it's from experience that it always has been an external factor that is initiating the community development initiatives. But I would always emphasize on, you know, when we say a real community development, then if it's consciously coming from the people, then that would be that would, you know, meet the sentiments of the people. But in reality, it's not happening always. In reality, it's like the community development initiatives are mostly emphasized, influenced, or imposed by external factors or different, you know, non-governmental organizations or international, bilateral, multilateral organizations. So I would say this is the biggest challenge, you know, because they can't really grab the issue, grab the sentiments of what people are going through.
And I think added to that is the problem of funding, really, because we can kind of criticize the NGOs or the external people coming in, but then that's where the money is often coming from. And in order for a community to like hold on to its own issues and interests, they might have to resist some things that the NGOs would be funding. For example, when I was working on a project in Myanmar, it was initiated by a community and came through the community about a schooling, and it was kind of for peace, but I won't go into it. But what I wanted to say is to get funding, the people who were funding at the time were hoping to fund initiatives that focused on gender or focused on literacy. And so they had to write their proposal maybe in a certain way that fitted the interests of the external people. And then it's how much does that then shape the activity, because then they're looking at accountability and indicators, and how do you hold on to that vision and that energy whilst you're still trying to get funding. So I think that's interesting.
I totally agree on what you said. It's just like practically speaking, you're right that whatever initiatives these community come across, but, you know, the whole structure requires the professionalism, you know, requires the understanding, the all the structural formatives and everything, so which limits the sentiments of those people of the, what they really want to do. And in on other hand, they also face, like, you know, their knowledge is not accepted widely. I'm talking about practical terms, because I would always emphasize that they know better than I do, you know. None of the experts would better know than they do of their community and about their problems. So this is one thing that really strikes me, and that always strikes me when I work as well. So it was like their knowledge, their understanding was not well acknowledged, well recognized. Instead, the experts were, you know, invited, and the experts had their say, they had their voice, and they, you know, always imposed their knowledge instead of acknowledging their, you know, the local indigenous knowledge and all. So that would be, I consider that as the biggest challenge we have so far.
How, in your own experience, have you tried to address this particular challenge? Like, what are some of the tools that you have worked around to get past this particular one?
Well, earlier we talked about, you know, I just mentioned briefly about reflect circles. That was the, you know, very crucial initiative that we came across. and implemented very successfully. That you know, influenced communities to come up with their issues, you know, and tackle with their own issues. So how we started was, we basically went to the community, you know, where there were like some problems within those communities. We identified them through different secondary sources, but we went there not as an expert. We went there just as a primary facilitator. And after we entered that community, we identified you know, the key persons who could understand, who has the basic understanding of their own issues. And you know, we collected the local people who had this better understanding. Then we kind of discussed about them, about what those issues are. Say, for instance, they had problems with, you know, about gender-based violence, about alcoholism, about unemployment and poverty. There were several issues that were affecting this community. So what we did basically was collected those key persons from that community, discuss these issues, and ask them to, you know, organize a circle, organize a forum informally within the community so that they could reflect by themselves. So, you know, they went to the community, they invited people, they organized these circles, they started, you know, discussing random issues about their family, about their personal life, about their community, and gradually they, you know, entered towards this discussion of different social issues that they had. And gradually they themselves identified that what their problem was. Like, for instance, I didn't say that you had a problem of alcoholism or you are poor or something like that, but it's like they themselves within the circle, they came up with these problems. And the facilitator was always, you know, like they posed questions like what could be done to mitigate alcoholism in their community, or, you know, what could be the basic solutions to, you know, alleviate poverty, absolute poverty within the community. So it was the community itself, it was the people themselves who came up with these ideas that what should be done to tackle all these problems. So that's how they started, and our role was just to support what their idea was. Our idea was just to, you know, support their action plan and just assist them. Rather, it was always the people who took leadership on implementing everything.
I'm just interested by that and how you would create the space where the community can come up with the issues and make sure that you're hearing all the voices, because I would be worried then like only certain things would come up, and how you would decide who was the local facilitator and whose issues were the most important and whose were silenced by this kind of community meeting.
Yeah, I would just like to add to it that how do you deal with power dynamics that emerge in such situations?
Well, the biggest, you know, limitations we had was we had to organize these circles within the homogeneous group, where people would feel they are on the same page or they are on the same status within the community. Otherwise, you know, when I went to those communities, it was always power dynamics. There were upper class people, lower class, upper caste, lower caste, you know, this whole gender issues of men and women, who holds the power, everything. But what we did basically was we were just the observer. But everything was done by the local people. Even the facilitator was local, but we had some, you know, conversations with the local facilitator. We had some interactions with the people. But, you know, on the front line, on the leadership, it was always the local, the local facilitator who would know the power dynamics, who would understand, you know, who holds the say and everything. But when it comes to the group, you know, it was always like mostly there will be some influencing people, I mean, which cannot secure, like, every people would have their say. But the facilitator would deal that tactically, you know, listen to the voice of those influencing people in a group, and at the same time, you know, go to the people directly, approach individually, visit their homes, and, you know, understand what they have to say, and record that, and build in a way that they would feel comfortable with. So I think that worked in my case.
At this point, we can take the opportunity to pause for a few moments and gather our thoughts as we ask our guests to suggest a piece of music for us.
I have this very instrumental music which mostly relates with my local culture. Yeah, it's kind of indigenous folk music of Nepal.
Very well, here it is then. Welcome back. That was a beautiful piece of music. Coming back to our discussion, we left off at how local knowledge and local expertise can be utilized in community development and how people see their local resource personnel as helpful and empowering to them. But then there is another notion of how when the external person is present who is not local to that particular community, and then sometimes people look up to them as well, and the whole concept of expert knowledge comes in. So any one of you would like to comment on it?
In my experiences, I've generally been quite obviously an external person, whether it be like language or my nationality or something. And that's been a real barrier to me, I think. I absolutely agree with what Saroj has said and think that it's so important that it comes from the community, that facilitators are local and understand their community. But at the same time, when I've been there, there's been this assumption that I know more about something and people will like look to me. And from my background with anthropology, I like to kind of observe things. So I would prefer to be sitting in a meeting, trying to understand the dynamics and then think about how we can approach things, like what Zoro said about observation. But sometimes that can be difficult if you're trying to support a local facilitator who then is looking for you to answer things. And there's a strange sort of power play, I suppose, and you're just waiting for each other to give each other the answers. So I think sometimes this kind of participatory on community, like I think that community ownership is great and is very important, but at the same time it can be like romanticized a bit, and it's assumed that the community are going to want or be comfortable with that immediately. It's the same with the participatory thing. I remember when I was just starting out, I was doing like a seminar series with a women's group, and I had always understood participation as like the way to do education or community development. But when I went in and I had all these like plans, I was very excited about doing these participatory dialogues. Everyone's going to talk about their issues, but really it was like silent and very awkward for me. And nobody wanted to tell me anything. And they just wanted to listen to me and have me as a like expert from the UK to give a PowerPoint presentation on gender and food. And it made me very uncomfortable, and it made them very uncomfortable when I was asking them questions. So it was such important about understanding what the expectations are and what the needs are from the community. So that was my experience of being like an external person and having to manage that.
Well, I agree on what you say. Even in my communities, so far for last 5 decades, it has always been influenced by external resource person or external facilitators, because we perceived in a way that we are so backward. The community people, they perceive that they don't know anything, they have no knowledge, no resources, and they should follow what external persons are saying. But different programs and different projects, even different community development initiatives that were organized, were designed in a way that was more influenced towards the external factor. I mean, it might be external from that community, or it might be external from that country. So it was all, importing ideas and everything. But later on, when we started reflecting on what we did in our community, we found that we had lost so many things that we had. And many things had been, covered up with these, multinational commercial products. Many things were influenced by, globalized ideas on business and on society, on cultural values, on many aspects. So when we started reflecting on what we did in our community, it was always like we didn't recognize the community values, we didn't recognize their strength, we didn't recognize their resources, what they have. Instead, we imposed so many issues, just making them as an object and not valuing what they had. But later on, we thought that we should preserve what we have as well. We should understand what is our resources, and we need to utilize the resources that we have. And that's really important. And that's respecting and acknowledging the knowledge and the skills that we already have, instead of relying on the external factors and the external knowledge. We are trying to emphasize on the communities to look up on themselves, to observe, to reflect on what we already have. And that's the biggest strength so far in terms of community development, because we talk about collective action and we talk about the knowledge that the community brings along. So these are the most important factors, I would say, for a community development.
What you just said makes me think about how globalization has impacted the notion of community development itself and how the community development practices from all across the world. Some people are trying to homogenize them, but that's, in my personal opinion, I find it very disturbing because so many communities are so diverse and we need to acknowledge the diversity and acknowledge the fact that different contexts require different kind of practices. And Hannah, what would you like to say on that? Because you work with different types of communities like in Spain and Myanmar, and different communities require basically just different approaches at times.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting what Suresh was saying about he's been working with sort of homogenous communities, mm-hmm. and that makes it sort of easier to understand the dynamics. And I think what you were saying about realizing what the community has and your kind of collective vision and how that was important for community development, I think that is an issue that would be a challenge in more fragmented societies. So if I look at community in general in the UK where I'm from, I don't even see a community, like it would be very difficult to bring together a community, I think, because people live their own lives. People are quite individualized, perhaps also in your context as well, but the way you were describing them earlier, I thought maybe it was less so. But yeah, it would be very easy for people not to be involved with that community, and I don't think there's an interest in the community anymore. So if somebody came in to do work with a community, I don't know who they would reach. I think maybe they would only reach those who are already actively involved, and so lose a lot of potential, I guess.
At this point, I would also like to explore the notion that education these days is a lot more individualistic because I would want to learn what benefits me, whereas the notion of community development is a collective one. How, in your experience, you bring these two fields together? How do you bring education and community development together when they deal with two different phenomena?
Well, as I was saying that we are, you know, losing what we had. You know, we are losing our values. We had this thing of, you know, collectivity, communal practices, you know, everything, all the cultural values were associated with these communal feelings and sense of ownership in the community, you know, feeling of belongingness and meaningful in the community. But as the society is changing, you know, it's been more individualistic. Even the education so far has, you know, it relates to what I want to learn and how do I want to learn, how is it going to benefit me. But previously, if we go back to our history in my context, then it was always collective thing. It was about learning from each other, learning from society, you know, learning together, and you know that would lead towards collective action of social change, and the social change that would benefit for the whole community, not just for individual. So that was some you know a thing that really impressed me always. But we are, as I said, we are losing this value of collectiveness and, you know, education being more inclined towards individualistic.
I think individualism is a really hard thing to tackle, especially as it's become almost, you can't really argue with the fact of individual freedom. And I think it's individualism has been understood in terms of freedom and human rights as well. And education has kind of become part of that. Each person has a right to education for all, and with the kind, this is sort of all part of neoliberalism, I understand it, and each person, I guess it's like the American dream. If you educate yourself, then you can live however you like. And so even though the education that we learn about, education for social change, is about the collective and the social good, it's sort of getting ruined by individualism. And if we look at the documents from sort of the European Union and the reports by the UNESCO and things, that they idealize the social, but at the same time, on policy level, it's about individualism and vocational skills. Yeah, it's sort of like a meritocratic myth of making yourself better rather than the community better.
Well, I think it depends on the purpose of education. It depends on where you're coming from as well. So for me, it's like I get education because I want to, you know, do something for my society. So that would be not for me, that would be for the society in general. So that's the culture that I bring for my education as well. But I would always say it depends on where you come from or what are your values.
I think it also would depend on like which type of education we're talking about. So in formal education, it's very much ruined by assessment. And I think it's very hard now as university students to look past our own individual experience of education, because we can learn together, but then in the end of the day, we have our own assignments to worry about. And then we're going towards our own degrees and qualifications and maybe be competing for jobs. So yeah, I think it depends, because then non-formal and informal education is more, could be more collective, but that assessment is sort of bringing in that individualism into it.
I'm afraid that's where we'll have to wrap up the discussion for today, but it was indeed very much stimulating for myself. And here I would like to leave you all with a quote from Margaret Mead, and it goes along the lines with what you were saying, Saroz, that never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. Thank you to our panel, Hannah and Saroz, for valuable insights. And also thank you to our technician, Samuel. The Talking Heads series is available online at maltauniversitybroadcasting.com. All that remains for me is to say thank you for listening and goodbye.